This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. My guest is writer Edmund White, who has candidly described gay life in his novels and nonfiction. Ed White came out to the publishing world when he co-authored the book The Joy of Gay Sex. In the late 70s, White traveled to different gay communities around America, recording his impressions of the lifestyles, social scenes, and politics he found. He adapted his journal into the book States of Desire: Travels Through Gay America. White's acclaimed 1982 novel, A Boy's Own Story, is about a young gay's coming of age in the Midwest. Like the boy in the novel, White grew up in the Midwest, where he felt very isolated. He moved to New York as a young man in 1962, and later became active in the gay liberation movement. Since 1983, Ed White has lived in Paris, where he's a contributing editor to Vogue magazine. Many of Ed White's readers were surprised to find that his new novel, Caracol, concerns the adventures of a young heterosexual man. I asked Ed White how he reacts to the label gay writer.
Well, I think that oftentimes writers get labeled one way at the beginning of their career, and then later they get labeled another way. If they're any good and they survive, I think that Faulkner was originally, for instance, considered a regional writer and then later became considered a universal writer. I think Colette was originally considered a feminist writer, not even a feminine writer, a writer for women. And now I think she's considered a universal writer. Same goes for Virginia Woolf. So I think that it seems only normal that someone would be pigeonholed. There's so many writers. Everybody's competing for everyone's attention. It seems only normal that you would be labeled that way at the beginning of your career. But I think one of the unfortunate things about our entire society in America now is that people have stopped speaking to each other. It seems to me that black books are mainly bought by black readers, that feminist books are mainly bought by women, and that one of the classic and historic and I think admirable ideals of literature is to create a kind of giant conversation amongst all the different factions of our society. To a large degree, that still is going on in a country like France, partly because it's highly centralized, partly because there are no ghettos, and partly because it's still very much their notion of what it means to be a civilized man or woman is to know a great deal about other people. In America, you wouldn't say that we're isolated, it's just that we're ghettoized.
Yeah, so different populations, so to speak, don't read each other's
books
right. as much.
For instance, A Boy's Own Story in America was treated as a gay book, and I would suspect that 95% of its readers were gay. In England, it was a bestseller that was on the bestseller list for 10 weeks that was read by everybody, and most of the reviews didn't even mention that it was gay. People seem to think that it said a lot about adolescence in general.
When you were first starting to write and first trying to get published, do you think that being gay was an obstacle at all?
Oh, very much so. I have always written about gay themes from the time I wrote my first novel when I was 14 years old. And by the time I got into my 20s, I was writing novels with gay themes that were always rejected, partly maybe because they weren't any good. Although years later, after gay liberation, I would meet gay editors who had been in the closet and working for major publishers who told me that they had read my book and liked it, but they'd been afraid to recommend it because they were afraid that people would think they were gay if they came out in favor of my book. So it wasn't until after the Stonewall Rebellion of 1969, the beginning of gay liberation, well after that, that I began to get published. And even so, the first book that was published, Forgetting Elena, is only gay by virtue of participating in this mysterious thing called the gay sensibility. There are no explicit gay scenes in it.
After your first or second novel, you co-wrote the book The Joy of Gay Sex. And I wonder what effect that had on your literary career. And one, because it was a self-help-oriented book about sexuality. Two, because it was definitely a gay book. And you were a novelist, best known as a novelist until then.
I think that it had, it didn't pigeonhole me as a sort of self-help writer amongst gay people, because what the interesting thing is, if you compare The Joy of Sex with The Joy of Gay Sex, you see that whereas almost all of The Joy of Sex for heterosexuals is about sexual positions, The Joy of Gay Sex about 40% of the book is devoted to lifestyle questions like coming out with your parents, sex and religion, how to write a will with your beloved that you live with who isn't, that has no legal status in your life, and so on. So I think gay people understood that this was a sort of handbook about being gay and that it dealt with coming out issues as much as it dealt with sexual positions. In fact, I think that Masters and Johnson demonstrated a long time ago that lesbians and gay men have a great deal fewer questions about their partners than heterosexual partners do because, after all, one's dealing with a member of the same sex. So you understand to some degree the anatomy and the physiology of the body that you're in bed with. There are fewer mysteries. You're not dealing with the opposite. You're dealing with the same. So I think that that what people were looking for in that book was reassurance and guidance in terms of lifestyle rather than sexuality.
Was that book a dramatic coming out of sorts for you because there was no way to, you know, keep that you were gay in the closet at all, even, you know, even if you wanted to for one manuscript that you were submitting?
It was definitely a big coming out for me. The publisher was totally indifferent to whether I used my real name or a pseudonym because they were selling the name of the book, not the name of the writer. At that time, I was not a very well-known writer at all. So it was totally the same to them whether I used my name or not. But I finally decided it would be ludicrous to write a book in which I was encouraging people to come out without coming out myself. But it is true that there was no looking back once I had done that. But it was very, very liberating to me personally. I think that my life took a turn toward being much happier after I wrote that book because I think for the first time I really was out. I thought that I had come out years before by telling a few friends, but having come out professionally that way, I think was very liberating. I then went on to write States of Desire, which is my travel book about the United States, and I think there's a kind of exuberance about that book, a kind of confidence, which I had never really had in my writing before. And I think it's a real result of this new sense of security that I had, a new sense of having consolidated my own identity.
How much of a period did you go through of feeling very insecure about being gay? I mean, did you ever go so far as to like try to, you know, convert, so to speak?
Oh, absolutely. I was endlessly going out with women throughout my 20s, and I was in psychoanalysis for 12 years, and I was, an unusually slow learner. I mean, I was an unusually conservative and backward person. This is a period of my life that I'm now writing about in a new novel, which is called The Beautiful Room is Empty, and it is a sequel to A Boy's Own Story, and it takes the boy from college up through the Stonewall Rebellion in 1969, which is the beginning of gay liberation, and one of the things I'm trying to show in this book is that the quality of friendships amongst gay and lesbian people was very good. It was a lot of fun, but the qualities of love affairs were not very good because there was too much self-hatred. I mean, that degree of intimacy was hard to sustain. But friendships were fun and fine, and it's a mistake to look at that period as being nothing but gloom or depression. And I think my book, I hope, if I get it right, will be full of both shadows and also sunlight. You know.
Did your psychiatrist try to turn you into a heterosexual?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
What kind of techniques did they use for that?
Well, I was in group therapy, and I was the only gay in a group of about 14 straight people. And after all, you have to remember that people think in terms of metaphors. We all do. And if the only metaphor that was available was either sin or crime or malady, that it was very hard to defend oneself. You don't want to say, well, yes, I want to be a sinner, or yes, I want to be a criminal, or yes, I want to be sick. Although, in fact, writers, earlier gay writers like Jean Genet did say that. I mean, I think some of the extreme statements that seem so shocking and violent in Genet come from the fact that there was no other way to affirm gay identity. He has to say, yes, I am a criminal and I am like Satan, and stand back and look at me in all my satanic glory. But I think that for less forceful or more ordinary people or more conventional or middle-class people like me, it was very hard to take that stand. And so I knew how irritating things were. I remember very well once telling my group therapy about a breakup with my lover, and I was in tears, and I was going through a tremendous experience, and suddenly this man sitting next to me from Brooklyn, a big, fat, straight guy, says to me, "I don't want to hear this crap. Tell me about the Goyles in your life. Tell me about the Goyles." Well, I blew up, and I've never been so mad, and the psychiatrist had to stand up and part us, actually, because for the first time, I just really wanted to smash somebody, because I felt like I have listened and helped everybody in this group as they've gone through all of their problems with their wives or husbands or whatnot. For the first time, when I really want to share my own experience, because I was always rather reticent in that group, I get this kind of treatment, you know, and... Well, there were flashes of anger like that, but there was no way to systematize them until gay liberation, when suddenly the metaphor changed from sickness to oppression. Suddenly we could see an analogy between ourselves and, let's say, blacks. And black pride was, we made it just a straightforward translation into gay pride.
How political did you become after Stonewall?
Quite. And I had never been political before. I'd always been somebody with a coat and tie on, working for Time Life Books, sort of looking wistfully out the window as the hippies and the Vietnam War protesters and the pop artist and all these other movements were sort of trailing by, and I felt very much like a kind of yuppie before the time. But suddenly afterwards, I did become quite political. I was active in the Gay Academic Union, which was an early group, and in Christopher Street, which is a gay publication. I was one of the founding members of that and published things right away in there. And so I did become active politically, and we had a lot of sit-ins and other protest demonstrations in that period too.
My guest is writer Edmund White, and he has a new novel. It's called Caracol, and it's just been published by Dutton Books. I know I've read that when you came to New York that you were just so amazed, and I think delighted to find that there was not only a gay community and gay bars, but there were gay restaurants, too, that there was just a whole subculture where you could be open and, you know, be with other gay men. And I was surprised to hear that you left Manhattan and moved to Paris. What were some of your reasons for leaving New York?
I think one thing is I'm 45, and I think that when you get it, when you become middle-aged, you can either sort of settle in for the duration, or you can shake your whole life up and renew yourself in that way too. So for me, it's interesting, like having been someone in America toward the end of my stay in New York who was always being interviewed, suddenly now in Paris I'm the one who goes out and I interview other people in my job for Vogue. I'm, again, a student. I mean, I was a teacher at Columbia in the creative writing program. But as soon as I got to Paris, I was taking French classes at the Alliance Française. It was a way of, you could say, rejuvenation in the sense of literally becoming a student again, a student of a new life, a new system, a new world. And also, Paris, I think, is a wonderful city to be gay in. I mean, it's not as though it's some second-rate version of New York. It has a very different character. But one that's equally interesting.
Well, I've heard from a lot of people that Europeans are just less homophobic than Americans are.
I think that's very true. I think that's very true. I think that we have such prominent and powerful gay ghettos in this country that we imagine that's what gay liberation amounts to. And I think that, in fact, those ghettos have been very important as a kind of first stage in liberation, because they have been places where people have been able to incubate their own identity and been able to work out who they are. But for me, what's important is to reintegrate oneself into society in general, to become a person, a member of society, not just a gay person hovering within the ghetto. And I think that, I mean, I've talked to black friends of mine who say it's easier to stay in Harlem in a way because you don't have those funny stares, you don't have that conflict, you don't have that constant friction with a different set of expectations and values. However, it's not as healthy to stay there. I mean, one needs to go out into the world and establish oneself as a member of society at large, I think. And for me, that's what part of what moving to Paris has been. I went with a friend, another American, and we have been always entertained by straight French couples. I mean, we will go to dinner where we'll be, let's say, the only male couple, but nobody says anything about it. I mean, we feel totally accepted by it and completely relaxed about it. And everyone knows we're lovers. It's completely open. But homosexuality as such is never discussed. I mean, I've oftentimes in America been invited by liberal heterosexual couples, let's say, to dinner, where they would say, they would then want to sort of interview me about what is it like to be gay, which isn't a very comfortable thing to do on a social level. And this was sort of a demonstration on their part that they accepted me, and I'm not faulting them. But it wasn't a kind of relaxed, everyday kind of a way of relating to another person.
So given the choice now, you'd prefer being in a kind of mixed community to being in what you now think of as the insularity of the gay community?
Yes. I mean, I do like the fact that for instance, a gay writer in America like Andrew Halloran or me or Robert Farrow, it's very unlikely that if the New York Times was doing a big question like, what do you think will happen to America in the next 20 years? It's very unlikely that we would be in their roundup of opinions. If they were doing specifically an article on homosexuality, they might ask us what we think about the future of homosexuals. But what if you said, what's going to happen about nuclear power, overpopulation, these other world problems? No gay writer would be asked about that. But in France, comparable gay writers like Renaud Camus or Yves Navarre or Dominique Fernandez, all three of whom have won the major literary awards there, comparable to our Pulitzer Prize. One of whom, Dominique Fernandez, is a major reviewer for L'Express, which is the counterpart to Time magazine. These people are members of the society at large. And when, for instance, Mitterrand wants to know what the French intellectuals think about French nuclear policy, and there's a sort of survey, they are asked. They're part of the community. They speak to other parts of the community. And I find this very, very refreshing. Even as an outsider in France, I just like living in a world where I feel there's that kind of communication.
Do you think that there's any differences between the way AIDS is affecting gays in France and in America, and also in the way it's being
perceived?
Yeah.
Yes, I think so.
And interpreted.
I think that the French press is much more responsible in this regard than the American press has been. I think that something like the New York Post's coverage of AIDS, which I find absolutely despicable, where you have like headlines that say, cook in school dies of AIDS. Why is that a headline? Why isn't that a page 20 story? You know, that just simply would not happen in France. For instance, the worst newspaper that we have in France is called France Soir, and it's nothing but, you know, mom eats babies and that kind of stories. Nevertheless, even their handling of the AIDS issue has been very responsible and scientific. I think that's the key word, that the press has an obligation to do a scientific kind of coverage of this story.
Do you think that AIDS has been interpreted by some people as retribution for excessive promiscuity?
Yes, definitely, of course, and I think that the born again Christians have specifically said so, that this is a sign of God's punishment, and that seems to me a tragic and cruel notion of a religion that is supposed to be based upon charity. I think perhaps even worse is that many gays themselves think that they've I think that after all, we live in a society that is phobic about pleasure in general, and especially about sex. It's not just gays who have problems about sex. It's everyone. And I think that oftentimes when gays think that they are guilty about being homosexual, what they don't realize is that what they're worrying about is what everyone worries about being sexual at all. But I think that these guilt feelings have been reawakened by AIDS, and I think it has certainly transformed gay society. Not altogether for the bad.
What are some of the transformations that you see happening?
Well, I think one of the main things that's happened is that there's been a new emphasis upon relationships and even monogamy. And certainly the rates that we see of the falling rates of venereal diseases among the gay populations suggest that there's a great deal less promiscuity than ever before.
You think that's good?
I don't know whether it's good or bad. I think what's interesting is that one of the bad things that was beginning to happen with the wide open promiscuity of the 70s was that I think many gay men were, not women, but gay men were beginning to treat each other as commodities. And you would say, oh, he's a hot number. He goes to the gym. He makes $40,000 a year. He jogs 4 miles. And he has such and such physical dimensions. And everything could be put in terms of numbers, you know, an amount of money, number of years of age, and so on. Everything could, in other words, it was a very dehumanizing way of regarding oneself. And I think that one of the good things that has come out of a situation that no one could ever have wished for, and that is absolutely tragic, nevertheless, one of the good things that's come out of it has been a new way of looking at oneself and other people in terms of real qualities, real human qualities, not just these superficial ones. I've talked to some gay guys the other day in Boston who were telling me that for the first time, these are men in their 30s, they have friends in their 60s. You know, since they're no longer out looking for sexual partners, they're really looking for friends, and they find that they're responding to men who are funny looking or who are old or who are poor or who aren't, but who are wonderful. And so they're beginning to see these human qualities. And I think so there's been this kind of humanizing impact on the gay community.
The people who were at the vanguard of the gay liberation movement in the late 60s and early 70s are getting older now. I mean, they're in their 40s. They're not in their teens and 20s and early 30s anymore. And there has been a real premium on youth and good looks. Now that the people who were at the vanguard of that movement are getting older, do you think that that's going to change? Do you see any shifting emphases?
Yes, I can't imagine that my generation, who fought so hard for their rights as gay men, would be willing to now slink off to some sort of elephant's burial ground and die a quiet death as aging gays. I think that we've always been loudmouth, and I imagine that we'll start challenging some of these ideas of ageism, too.
In terms of the ideas that are challenged by homosexuality and lesbianism, do you think that there's a connection to feminism and its challenge to gender roles?
Oh, definitely. I think so. I mean, Kate Millett in Sexual Politics 100 years ago said that what she liked about Genet's books was that the drag queens in Genet's novels, who were such skillful, if shrill, impersonators of women, revealed that that these were not natural biological roles, but that they were socially induced and that they could be put on or discarded at a moment's whim. And so, in other words, life as theater is a kind of metaphor that I think gays and lesbians understand very well. And I think it's been part of the feminist critique also to look, I mean, the word roles, which is a theater word, is one that I think has been very important to all three of these ideological groups.
As a writer, do you feel that there's any silent or spoken pressure on you to write books or create characters who are seen as positive role models or, you know, books with happy endings so it could leave you optimistic about your future if you're gay and you're reading it?
Yes, there is that kind of pressure, but I think that it is beginning to die out. I think gays are becoming more sophisticated. I felt that more, let's say, 5 or 6 years ago, at a time when I think that the gay press was dominated by some of the early gay liberationists who had a sort of a Stalinist approach to things, and literature was seen as propaganda. Now I think that the gay movement has matured sufficiently that we now are interested in showing gay life and even straight life in all of its variety, in seeing how issues of role reversal, of dominance, of power and money, all the great sort of discourses that underlie our society, how these weave together. This is the kind of thing that we're looking at now, rather than simply showing a happy, self-confident gay man.
One quick last question. You were talking before about how you'd like to think that your novels are being read by people who aren't only just like you. You want to talk to a diverse audience, a range of people. Sometimes when a writer who is gay is reviewed in a newspaper or magazine, they prefer to be reviewed by a gay reviewer who, you know, might have deeper insights into the themes they're writing about. And I wonder what you think about that, knowing that, you know, you want to reach an audience beyond gay readers.
Oh, I think that's silly to only want to be reviewed by other gays. I think that the whole premise upon which literature is based is that it is possible to communicate to other people, that it is possible to recreate imaginatively what one's life is like and to get that across. And I think that one of the wonderful things about reading, I was just reading an interesting essay by Mary McCarthy, and she was saying that whereas the people who collect painting are oftentimes quite poisonous people, and that painting, beauty, and art doesn't seem to humanize people very much. Nevertheless, the people who not just collect books but read them, real readers, tend to be nice people. And I think that's true, because I think that if you have really, as a reader, been Richard Wright's native son, if you have been Mrs. Dalloway, if you have been Père Goriot, if you have felt your way into David Copperfield, that you have had your horizons expanded. And I would hope that gay fiction could also play this role in recreating what our experiences are like for straight people.
That was Ed White, my guest on this edition of Fresh Air. Ed White's novels include A Boy's Own Story and Caracol. Fresh Air is a production of WHYY Radio in Philadelphia. The engineer for this edition was Joyce Lieberman. Fresh Air is edited by Maeve McGoran. Amy Salad is the associate producer. Danny Miller and I co-produce the show. My name's Terry Gross, and I want to thank you for listening.
This edition of Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order a cassette of this interview or for a listing of other Fresh Air programs available on cassette, call toll-free 800-253-0808. In Alaska and Wisconsin, call 608-263-4892. The number again for a cassette of Fresh Air is 800-253-0808. National distribution of Fresh Air is made possible with the financial support of listeners to WHYY-FM, Philadelphia. Additional funding comes from National Public Radio member stations and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.